When the first European explorations of the Himalayas began in 1921, Mount Everest became a symbol of Great Britain's renewal after the devastation of World War I. Wade Davis's latest book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest, chronicles the lives and experiences of the brave and ambitious men who attempted to conquer this dangerously beautiful mountain. Two of them, George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, died on their attempt to summit Everest in 1924, and it's still not known if they ever made it to the top. Wade Davis, the noted Canadian anthropologist, ethnobotanist, author, photographer, currently National Geographic's explorer in residence, tells their stories and the stories of other notable explorers with a look at the effect that World War I had on the men, their families, and their ambitions in this book, which is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings Wade Davis back to our show today. Welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now, hasn't your work focused on indigenous cultures around the world, especially in North and South America, and particularly involving the traditional uses and beliefs associated with psychoactive plants? Is this a real departure for you?
Well, not really. I sort of live by Marshall McLuhan's adage that if it works, it's obsolete. And if you actually look at my career, I sort of dip into something with great intensity, whether it was Haitian voodoo or Amazonian plant exploration or the celebration of cultures around the world. And actually, I see the book Into the Silence as a kind of a natural growth out of all that work in a certain sense. And of course, my first love in life was history. I went off to Harvard to be a historian and got diverted by anthropology.
Well, the first time we spoke was in 1985 when The Serpent and the Rainbow, which became a bestseller after you appeared on the show, about zombies in Haiti, was published. So let's talk about the people you write about in this book. Charles Howard Bury, a coordinator and explorer in the 1921 exploratory group, was very interested in Tibetan religious sites and traditions. So I imagine that was a connection for you.
Well, I think, you know, one way to sort of introduce this book is to sort of, you know, it came to me in a kind of serendipitous way. I was traveling on an ecological survey across Tibet, 4,000 miles in 1996. We happened to go by the flank of Everest when the disaster happened that John Krakauer so wonderfully wrote about, Into Thin Air. And with me was Daniel Taylor, who was a son and grandson of medical missionaries in Tibet. And I think Daniel was particularly concerned about the commercialization of Everest, which had led to that debacle. And the next year, Daniel and I, by chance, were back on the east face of Everest trying to photograph snow leopards and clouded leopards, and we got caught in unusual snow conditions at the base of the Kanchung face. And suddenly Daniel began to talk about these eccentric Englishmen dressed in tweeds who read Shakespeare to each other in the snow.
Well, Mount Everest is a very religiously important area for the people who live there. Did the first explorers respect the significance of the area?
They didn't have any idea of the mystic resonance of the land through which they were moving. Everest itself is not the sacred mountain of kind of hippie ethnography. It's actually just one of many mountains in a massif, but the landscape itself resonates with significance for the Buddhist faith. But I think...
But it is the tallest mountain.
It is
the
tallest mountain.
So that would give it a little more significance than the others?
Only in the European eye, not in the Buddhist eye. But I think the fascinating thing is that these men who... You know, the quest for climbing Everest, which began as a gesture of redemption for an empire of explorers that had lost the race to the North and South Poles, because of the intervening war, it emerged as a gesture of redemption for a people and a nation bled white by the war. And so the men who went to... And this is what really interested me in the story. You know, I was never interested, per se, in whether George Mallory got to the top before he died. I wanted to know what motivated him to keep walking.
It is interesting that Britain had access to the area for many years before it gained control of India in 1858. But was there a little interest in climbing Mount Everest until the early 20th century?
No, there was talk of climbing Everest as early as the 1880s. But remember, Nepal was completely closed to the British, and access to the mountain from the north through Tibet was problematic. And in the end, it was actually an arms deal facilitated by Charles Bell, and Charles Howard Bury was the one who sort of requested that part of that deal, in a sense, be the permission to walk across the mountain, the Tibetan plateau, even to find the mountain. You have to remember these men in 1921 had to walk 400 miles off the mountain off the map just to find the mountain. Now, what interested me...
But there had been an earlier expedition planned in 1915 that was suspended.
Because of the war. Everything was changed by the war. And the men who emerged, and as Tom Longstaff famously said, as they tried to recruit climbers once they had permission, the supply of climbers in Britain was somewhat less than it had been before the war. In fact, they had been decimated.
Well, you describe a great deal of the experiences of the explorers during World War One. Why is what happened to them years before their attempt to climb so important?
First of all, it wasn't years before.
Well, 1918, 1921, okay, 3 or 4 years.
Well, the first attempt, I mean, these are the entire generation. What interested me was to know what death meant to these men. And so I, over 10 years of research, I found out where each one of the men on the three expeditions, all 26 men, were every single day of the Great War. And if you want to know one anecdote to sort of express the connection to the war, let me share this. On the approach march in 1921, Arthur Kellis, a high-altitude physiologist, literally died of exhaustion. He was buried at a place called Campuzong. I discovered in my research long-lost journals by the man Oliver Wheeler, who was seconded to the expedition by the Survey of India. I found his son living in Vancouver, five doors from where I was born.
He's a fellow Canadian, strong climber, but he was kind of denied the opportunity, wasn't he? Because he was...
Well, on the contrary, Mallory disdained Canadians, but he was not at all denied the opportunity. He climbed with Mallory to the North Col in 1921. But on the approach march, the day they buried Kellis, his journal annotation says simply, "They buried the old man in the morning. Terribly sorry to have missed it. Thought it was going to be the afternoon, but I do hate funerals." Well, wait a minute. How do you miss the interment of one of your fellow climbers as six of you are marching across Tibet? Well, there had to be more to the story, and there was. During the war, he was attached to the 7th Merritt Division of the Indian Corps, and after the annihilation of the British Expeditionary Force in the first 2 months of the war, the Allied line, the British part of the Allied line, was held in the north by the Canadians and the south by the Indian Army. By that point, the topography of Armageddon had come into place, and both sides were building saps to each other, perpendicular trenches running out of the main trench line so you could get close to the enemy line and lob bombs or trench rage, etc. And it came to the attention of Wheeler's command that the Germans had put two saps within 30 feet of their front line. He and his battalion were given orders to go over the top to eliminate the sap and do so in a way the Germans would be dissuaded from ever trying it again. So in November of 1914, they go over the top, all hell breaks loose, and they discover to their horror that the saps are full of Germans about to attack them. The result is a melee of conflict of the worst sort imaginable, eyes ripped out, noses gouged off. And in the end, the Indians push the Germans back, but not before the sap is completely lined, thick with bodies, chest to chest, of dying young boys of both sides. And Wheeler is forced to bury them alive. So when on Tibet he says, "I do hate funerals," that's the depth of the resonance of the war in the lives of the men who went to Everest.
But do you think it also inured them to certain senses of dangers? After all, they had miraculously survived when so many others had died.
I don't think anyone who went through the war felt they were somehow immune to death. They felt they were just statistically lucky to have survived. But I do think that death meant something more to them. Death, you know, what death had no mystery to them. They'd seen so much of death that what mattered less was, you know, life mattered less in the moments of being alive. That's really the theme of the book, in a sense.
Well, two of the explorers, John Noel and Charles Howard Bury, have been captured during the Germans during the war.
Well, Noel is not just captured. I mean, Noel, for example, famously went to his death speaking incessantly about his contributions on the Western Front. The truth is, I found out in my research that he suffered shell shock at the Battle of Ypres, and he spent much of the war convalescing in a hospital. Howard Bury, on the Somme front, was forced one night to dig trenches several hundred yards through a corpse field of rotting, maggoted, you know, I mean, the horrors these guys, you know, endured are so extraordinary that I do think when they went to Everest, they were prepared to take risks that would have been unimaginable before the war.
Well, obviously, they were suffering from what we would now call PTSD, and somehow that gave them, I guess, a certain amount of sense of bravado. You include remarkable details of the expeditions, like the items that the Tibetans they met gave the explorers as gifts, all all from these journals that you...
Well, you know, the amazing thing about, you know, the research process, I mean, starting with the war, for example, you know, it was famously said of the Battle of the Somme and Passchendaele that the British Army lacked the clerk power to tabulate the dead. But if that was the case, they kept records of everything else. And in terms of the war front in particular, remember, it was a very small frontage. The British front was never longer than 125 miles. It was often as short as 85 miles. Behind that frontage, they built 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. And that battlefield, which the entire zone of operations in the British front, was never larger than the English county of Lincolnshire. You had millions of men fighting, and every regiment kept their diaries. Every man wrote letters, their diaries, personal journals. And so there was no corner of that battlefield that hadn't been documented every single day of the war. So that was one source of information. And then on the Tibetan side, you know, I spent months in monasteries. I had the spiritual autobiography of Zatra Rinpoche, the famous Lama of Rongbuk, translated by monks in Kathmandu. I spent months living in monasteries so I would understand the world that Mallory encountered in 1921.
And had they remarked on these Englishmen who were coming to climb the mountain?
In 1922, Zatra Rinpoche, in his journal, spoke of his sympathy for men who were prepared to embark on such a foolish mission for no goal.
And he was right. Well, forget about the no goal part. It was a foolish mission because they went so unprepared. It may be the reason that nobody attempted to climb Everest again for another 20-something years.
Oh, no, that's not what happened. I mean, they were prepared to go in 1925 had they been able to get permission from the Tibetans.
But they were going with leather shoes on and...
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about how they were poorly equipped. Actually, they had state-of-the-art equipment for their time. I mean, George Finch invented the down vest, the down jacket for Everest. It wasn't really an issue of their equipment, although it held them back. You know, their boots were problematic, their ropes were not strong, etc. But that, you know, Everest is not a technical mountain. It's a mountain of endurance. And so that wasn't really the impediment. The challenge on Everest is always the weather. It's not really, you know, your technical prowess. So I think it wasn't that they were ill-equipped to climb the mountain. In fact, there's a good chance that George Finch in 1922 could have made the top. And it still remains a mystery as to whether or not Mallory did or did not make the top.
Most histories of the first expeditions have focused on George Mallory's role, but do we know much about Sandy Irvine, his companion on the final climb?
Well, one of the things, you know, there's a controversy because of the fate of Irvine to die at age 22 on the mountain. And
well, they found Mallory's body, but they've never found Irvine's body.
No, but I think the question is, why were these men so enamored of this young Irvine? And the answer has been from various historians, including the purient notion that Mallory somehow designs on the young Irvine. I mean, Mallory's experimentation sexually before the war was part of the kind of the bohemian culture of Cambridge. He was, by the time of 1924 expedition, thoroughly in love with his wife, with a handful of kids, and anyone who knew Sandy Irvine knew he was wildly and devilishly heterosexual. That clearly was not the point. On the one hand, Irvine was ferociously strong. He was mechanically a savant. He was capable of dealing with the oxygen apparatus. But more importantly, the men were enamored of Sandy Irvine because he had been too young for the war. And he embodied in his innocence, his power, his hope, his optimism, all the values for which they had fought and for which so many of their friends and brothers had died.
Well, they actually, for a while, they weren't sure whether they even wanted to bring some supplemental oxygen, but eventually they decided to do it. What about all of the non-Europeans who were involved in this? The Sherpas, for example, don't get very much credit, but they were really better climbers, weren't they? Better prepared?
No, not at all initially. I mean, the Sherpa, of course, in the 20th century history of climbing have been absolutely pivotal, and they are the back upon which all expeditions climb Everest today. But in the early days, the Sherpa had never been on a mountain like this. Mallory had to train them in ice techniques. So it's not right to say that the Sherpa, you know, carried Mallory up this flank. On the contrary, these were climbs that were facilitated by local porters, but by all means, these were these were the dreams of the Europeans, because, of course, for the Buddhist perspective, climbing Everest and flinging yourself into a zone of death where oxygen deprivation is such that you lose consciousness is the most foolish act you could possibly imagine.
How aware were they of the dangers that they faced? There was a glacier that they didn't even seem to notice.
Well, no, they were acutely aware but uncertain of the consequence of entering the death zone of oxygen. They weren't certain that if they use an oxygen apparatus, what would happen if it failed. But they were more than anything simply unprepared for the extremes of altitude. You know, it's one thing to embark on a polar expedition and endure such extremes of temperature and exposure. It's quite another to do so walking vertically to the top of the world. And indeed, in 1921, reaching the top of Everest was as ambitious an achievement as reaching the surface of the moon.
Wade Davis is the best-selling author of more than a dozen books, including The Serpent and the Rainbow and One River. He currently holds the post of National Geographic Explorer in Residence. And he will be speaking at the Rubin Museum tonight at 7 o'clock. That's on 17th Street and 7th Avenue. The book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest, is published by Knopp. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Great to see you again.